General Government Subcommittee, April 27th, 1999, 1 p.m., Hearing Room 174.
Hub of Ways and Means, General Government Order. First on our agenda this afternoon is Senate Bill 5541, the Department of Revenue. Mr. Jim Brown, did you have any more you'd like to say? Or? John Berg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Jim Brown with the Department of Revenue. Actually, the only thing additionally we wanted to add was late yesterday afternoon, the issue of the $5 million came up in the question as to whether or not that was where the governor was on that. And I believe Mr. Gunther is prepared to address that.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and staff. The governor's position on it is, as we surmised yesterday, you folks, the committee, oh, by the way, for the record, I'm George Dunford, Department of Administrative Services, Budget Management Division. Excuse me. You provided the revenue to keep the budget in balance, and he is supportive of that amendment for that reason. So he does support that amendment as long as it stays in balance.
So the $5 million, so long as it comes out of revenues he can see and not out of the money that he's allocated for the budget, is okay with him to spend it this way in the budget to help local government out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Troy, I believe that's correct.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to bring to the members' attention that based on our discussion yesterday of the additional revenue generating package, the one that would add the $2.7 million at a cost of roughly $500,000 for a net of $2.2 million to the general fund, I have updated the schedules that I contributed to yesterday, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention that you have a memo and some updated schedules.
Can I ask a question of Sue in the budget? Sue, how much additional money now are we using the Department of Revenue to raise for our budget? Some of the money clearly comes just simply from taking money out of the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. That's $17 million. $5 million of which I think you would spend to do that program for local government. Additionally, we're adding positions in the auditing area, especially, and we're going to raise additional revenues. How much additional revenues are you raising total?
Mr. Chair, in the memo that I distributed to you today, right below the box of LFA recommendations, there's a paragraph that does answer your question.
Okay.
With the additional enhancements as adjusted by my recommendations yesterday, the department should be able to generate $16.1 million to the general fund at a cost of $5.6 million. So there would be a net gain of $2.5 million in the fund.
So that's what we've done with this budget. We were able to generate $10.5 million additional dollars for the general fund. With this budget by adding positions and so forth. Then in addition, we have shifted from the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program $17
million,
which can go to the general fund as well. Will go to the general fund, right? But the chair wants, and the department is okay, and the governor is okay, with spending $5 million of that for, what do we call that program that we're buying?
Part of the assessment and taxation program.
The assessment and taxation program.
Essentially the administration of the property tax program.
Right. Senator Leonard, you didn't come in, but the governor's office has said that expenditure is okay. They think it's reasonable. With what we're doing with this budget, it seems to me like that's a reasonable expenditure as well.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Troy, if I could just point out, of that total $27.5 million, over half of it is committed because the governor used the initial $12 million transfer from the program reserves of the Senior Citizens program to balance his budget, as well as the original revenue-generating package, and then after the May revenue forecast came out, added the second revenue-generating package. So those revenues are tied up. The $5 million that I recommended be transferred in addition to the 12, as you said, could be used to address the $5 million grants in grants to counties, and that would leave just the $2.2 million that's so far not in
already. Yeah. In other words, everything else but 2.2 is assumed in the government budget.
So not the 5 million.
Not the 5.
Not the 5 million or the 2.2.
Yeah, I'm just curious, did we hear and why the governor would support a $5 million expenditure that he hadn't had budgeted?
It's not coming out of the general fund dollars. It is true, $5 million that possibly could be spent otherwise than the way we're spending it in this budget, but he hadn't anticipated having that. And you want to ask the gentleman from DAS that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, would you mind restating that question? I'll be happy.
I'm just curious as to the rationale that you were given by the governor's office that they would agree to a $5 million expenditure. Maybe I misunderstood, but I thought it was a general fund expenditure that was not budgeted for, given the other issues we are grappling with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, you're correct. It was not in the original governor's recommended nor in the governor's revised recommended budget. However, the committee increased the amount of revenue available to the department by the additional $5 million transfer, I should say, not just to the department, but to the general fund, by the additional $5 million transfer, and that does not put the governor's recommended revised budget out of balance.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm thinking out loud, but I guess I'm wondering when we're going through budgets, 4% cuts in each budget. I thought the idea was to increase the K-12 budget, and if we cut the Department of Revenue budget and realize an extra $5 million, I guess I'm wondering why in this instance, what the rationale from whoever it was you talked to in the governor's office about spending it this way as opposed to in the K-12 budget.
You want to explain what the assessment does and how it affects the budget, how, if we didn't have this $5 million, what would happen in your department?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, the $5 million does not go into the department. It's in the budget bill. It's not money for the department to spend in its budget. We're merely a convenient pass-through entity because we currently collect the grant funds that come from the 4% interest increment and the real estate transfer fee. Those are sent to the department and we redistribute those funds to the counties. So this additional $5 million general fund appropriation would be added to those amount of monies that come from those other two areas to be distributed to the counties. So none of the money would end up in our budget as being spent. As I understand, in response to Representative Leonard's question, as I understand the governor's rationale, he has put together a rebalanced budget that funds schools at the level that he believes is appropriate. And the action of the committee has identified the money to pay for this $5 million program in your other actions that you've taken on the budget. And so he's comfortable that even with this balanced action that you've taken or you're considering taking, that there are adequate revenues to fund schools at the level that he's recommended in his revised budget. If this amount would have reduced that ability, I'm sure he would have been concerned.
Sure. Yes. That information comes from where in the governor's office or from whom?
From testimony from Mr. Denford.
That comes from my testimony. Mr. Chair, Senator, Representative Leonard, that Mr. Brown is extrapolating from my previous testimony.
But you went and had a conversation with the governor's office after our meeting yesterday, and that's what you were told?
I had a conversation with John Yonker.
All right, well, Mr. Chair, as I understood the explanation yesterday, this was $5 million that is a new appropriation that has never been appropriated before, and I recall you saying it was a pass-through to the counties, and as I understand it, to subsidize the county for the very first time in collecting public schools' portion of the property tax. Am I wrong about that?
That's my understanding.
Am I wrong?
No, I believe you're correct.
That's why Dr. Bear's saying I'm wrong, but that's how it was explained yesterday.
People proposing the amendment might want to come up.
Yeah, they might want to. That is the way I recall it here.
It would be interesting to know where this proposal came from and how it got here and this kind of stuff.
Is there someone in the audience who'd like to?
You're shaking your head. I mean, come up and tell me. Somebody. Hello.
Yes.
Chairman, I've lettered Gil Riddell, Association of Borden Counties. This $5 million is rounds out a bill that was passed by the House and is being considered by the Senate Revenue Committee now, House Bill 2139, which reauthorizes the Assessment and Taxation Funding Program drawing from interest on delinquent property taxes from cities and special districts, but not from schools. In addition, there was a recommendation that followed an interim study, a statutory interim study last interim, managed by the Department of Revenue, one of the recommendations of which was that the funding program should be changed so that the Department of Revenue gets its funding for this program, which involves two basic items. One is supervision of the program, and second is doing appraisals of industrial properties between $1 and $5 million from general funds and not from the assessment taxation fund. Instead of approaching those two elements by using a complicated interest from delinquent taxes out of each individual unsegregated tax account, which would affect different school districts differently and affect the backfill differently, and instead of taking the department's sharing of the fund and ending it, the idea was to instead roughly approximate, although it doesn't indeed, but roughly approximate what would be generated from those two elements and use it from newly available general funds.
Sir, my question really is, isn't this a new expenditure that has not occurred entire biennium from the general fund to the counties?
This is a new expenditure.
And I guess my concern is that notwithstanding what we may have heard from the governor's office, I mean, it's very gut-wrenching for us to sit here and go through like a library budget when we squeezed, as I recall, $78,000 out of their budget to save $28,000 in general fund dollars that affected some, I mean, out of a budget that's almost $700,000 or so. That was very gut-wrenching for us to go through, but just to hand it over $5 million, maybe it's just difficult for me, given the experience we've had with these other budgets and other programs, to just hand over $5 million on this basis with really little understanding of why we're doing it. And I appreciate the governor's support, but I just notwithstanding that, I'm just having a hard time getting there.
Mr. Reddy. Chairman, if I may comment, Representative Leonard, I hope it eases your internal deliberation to recall that the property tax system still provides a fundamental basis for school finance, that if the counties cannot do what they've been doing, and given the some $360 million of biennium loss as a result of federal forest revenues decreases and Measure 50 and the like, the issue of providing those kinds of services to the extent that we have in the past is really in jeopardy. The reauthorization of this program tries to advance the philosophy that was stated directly by a law from last session that you passed, that says that districts who benefit from the services
and indeed the private sector commerce that benefits from the records, the data, the mapping, ought to share a little bit in the cost. Counties now are paying some 80% out of county general funds to raise revenue for schools, to raise revenue for cities and special districts, to keep maps up to date, to keep records up to date for commerce. House Bill 2139 seeks to continue that. However, we did not want to burden your deliberation about school funding. We didn't want to make it any more complicated by going through this district-by-district sharing for the fund. Instead, thought it would be cleaner to do it this way. Now, we'd rather have more than the money that you've identified, but we'll certainly take that, and we think it's necessary to continue to provide the services that bring money into the school system.
Representative Hanson?
Hopefully, a couple quick comments. The proper collection of local property taxes is absolutely vital to the education budget. We've got every county in the state has a different funding mechanism for how they put their general funds together. There's a lot of counties, or several, that collect less property tax than they pay to run their assessment and taxation departments. There's a very real possibility as they go through more and more budget compression. The reasonable place for them to make cuts is with tax appraisers rather than public safety officials. If we allow that to happen, then we get uneven taxation, uneven collections. I mean, there's a real vulnerability to the portion of the education funds that are collected locally still through the property tax. And that $5 million investment is a way to shore that up. So, it's a new expenditure, but on the other hand, by not putting that expenditure in, we could be jeopardizing the education dollars that are already available. Sorry, Representative Leonard is out of the room now, because this isn't a new thing. This isn't the first time this idea has ever been brought forward. It's the product of a two-year interim study. I believe the governor certainly supported the interim study. This is the product of that study. It's part of a comprehensively addressing a problem that's been the counties and this legislature have been struggling with for many years. It's been complicated by property tax transfer legislation. It's been complicated by some sunsets that have been put on. It's been a long struggle. It's nothing new, but this is a part of the solution that was worked out over 2 years, and it's a good solution. It was addressed somewhat in the bill that's already passed the House. So that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that voted on that bill. So I think, this is kind of one of the final pieces of
the bill's into the film. I hadn't heard about it. I was completely new to me. And I wish that we had had in advance of the work session some discussion that this was coming and we knew where people were, because it was, just the last thing we did in a work session. And it was entirely new to me and a surprise. And I think to Senator Lim as well. And we hadn't heard anything about it. I don't think it's really objectionable at all. There is the question of, do we want to spend the $5 million this way, or is the $5 million that has been identified here something that could go into our budget deficit where we need it for various kinds of things? I guess that's sort of where we are. And I'd like to know why this is a very good expense. I know our chair wants to do it this way, and he's a former county commissioner and probably sees the need for doing it that way in the county that where he came from.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to
Before we go on with this debate, this is a public hearing, and the purpose is to hear from the public and the department. So the discussion I'm hearing here today should be in a work session, I believe. But if you have other clarification,
well, it's the same line yesterday. I was surprised to hear $5 million, I don't know for what. Not knowing it, tried to pass it out. I don't think it's fair. So I just want to concur with the Senator Joe mentioned about it.
Are there any other questions of let me ask, is there anyone else in the audience? Sir, would you like to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mike MacArthur. I'm the county judge in Sherman County and president of the Association of Oregon Counties this year. The Association of Oregon Counties identified the priority of assessment and taxation funding as one of the five priorities that we're bringing to the legislature early during the spring of 1997 session. So this idea has been around for some time. It's a practical matter for counties to continue to fund the assessment and taxation process that collects the taxes. The counties collect approximately 20%. The other 80% are turned over to other taxing districts, including about 50% of which goes to support the public schools. Under Measure 50, with the way that system works now, you must keep on top of new construction. New construction adds additional revenue not only to the counties and other taxing districts, but to the state for the funding of schools. So when I'm doing my budget in Sherman County or any other county, and we look at priorities, we're looking at public safety. This is probably our highest priority. We have many other competing needs in the county. It's difficult to justify some of the assessment and taxation spending, providing a service, essentially, for other taxing districts and the records that we keep for the public. We think that this is a good investment by the state to keep up a uniform tax system throughout the state that collects property taxes on the new construction so that those revenues are available to the state. We think it makes sense. It helps counties out in a time of very desperate need. In a lot of counties are very difficult circumstances. My county employees agreed to work next year with no cost of living increase in order to manage to keep their health insurance where it was. So we're not dissimilar from a lot of other counties in the state at this point in time. If we don't have additional resources in the assessment taxation system, it's going to begin to decline. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. How would that affect your county or my county's ability to collect taxes that would impact schools or any other source that they were to go to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, as I mentioned, under Measure 50, when a new construction comes on the rolls, that needs to be valued, the exception value process, so that we know what taxes are available. That takes some work on behalf of the, and some, I understand, some assessment and taxation, or assessment assessors, departments have stacks of these things waiting to be processed they can't get to because they don't have adequate staff. So until they're processed and put on the rolls, and if they're not put on the roll by a certain date, they don't count the next tax year. They aren't tax credit adequately collected. Does that answer your question?
And Mr. Chair, follow up. And that's a result of Measure 50 to change the way we essentially look at taxes now on a per property basis. There are different classifications, and so what you're saying in essence is increase your workload to have to do that, and the fact is we're not collecting the money, the property taxes, timely because they're not being stacked in material there, which the assessor hasn't gone through yet. Is that essentially it? Am I read that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, that is the potential situation that could exist, yes. And those properties were always evaluated under previous taxing systems. It's just become more critical now to time the process of the process. Thank you.
What was the process of getting from you all wanting money to do this to this subcommittee for this $5 million, which comes out of the reserves of the senior citizens' property tax deferral? How did you get from where you were to here for this $5
million? Mr. Chair, Senator Pro, as I mentioned earlier, this is an alternative way of of fulfilling the philosophy that was stated explicitly in a law you passed last session.
I understand that. I just want to know the process of getting here for this $5 million. Did you go to the co-chairs? Did they suggest you get it here? What, did somebody in the committee where you'd had a bill suggest this, the revenue committee? How did, because you knew about the $5 million before we knew about it. Or somebody did, anyway.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, we've had long discussions with leadership. Both the Senate and House have been recommending that this amount be included in the governor's budget. The Senate Budget Committee worked last summer. It's recommended that it be included there.
Was it in the Senate budget last summer?
I didn't ever see the result of that.
I've never seen that budget either.
We brought that to the attention of the Senate Budget Committee work group at that time. We've been working with the co-chairs.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead. Would you finish
that? Let me conclude by saying that we have been working with those people who write the budgets here, and it was suggested to us that was going to be included by the co-chairs.
Some budget somewhere, is that it? Or in the revenue Department of Revenue's budget?
Mr. Chair, Senator, correct.
So you found the money in the Department of Revenue's budget in a reserve fund, or somebody did.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure where the money was found.
Territorially?
Mr. Chairman, I object. The leading the witness.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to find some information.
The question of whether or not the county needed revenues is a moot question. It's something they brought every session since they were counties, I'm sure. But the A&D or the A&T issue has been one that's popped up a couple of sessions, and I think the issue was that they needed $5 million, and somebody said at many points in time, she will try and find that money somewhere. Whether that comes from the Department of Revenue budget or whether that comes from allocations of the President's budget, I don't know whether that's the most relevant thing we can discuss here. The issue is the co-chairs have found the allocation and made it, and this will commit it to the counties. I absolutely sympathize and understand the frustration of my colleagues that haven't seen the budget. I keep pointing out that the interim committee, which met for 18 months, produced the budget and published it. And the president produced the budget, he published it, and that's the budget we're working off of. And there probably will be a budget that no one has yet seen because nobody sat down and made the negotiations that will produce the budget version. And that's the synthesis between the governor's budget, the co-chair's budget, and that will probably happen after we're all set up with being in here for another month or two. But the fact is that this $5 million has been allocated from sources within the general fund to this purpose, and that's what's on the table, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I'm again going to ask the audience if there's anyone that would like to give further testimony. If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on 5541. At the chair's request, we will not go into work session until our chair returns, and I will open the hearing on House Bill 5056.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Maynard Warren. I'm president of Oregon Public Broadcasting, and it is a pleasure to be here today. We appreciate the opportunity to talk about one of our favorite subjects, Oregon Public Broadcasting. With me is Rob Ball, who is the chairman of our TV Board of Trustees. He's the senior partner in Ball Janik, and we will talk further on in this particular presentation. We're here to talk about what we do and how we do it, how well we do it, what it costs, and why the state partnership is crucial. We support the governor's recommended budget of $3.35 million for the biennium for Oregon Public Broadcasting, which represents about 10% of our overall operating budget. Just a little background. Oregon Public Broadcasting has been existing since 1922, first as part of the Oregon System of Higher Education, In 1981, we moved to our own agency with the help of Ways and Means Chair then, Jack Ripper, and then in 1993 became a 501c3. Oregon Public Broadcasting consists of 5 television stations, 4 radio stations, and about 52 radio and TV translators covering about 90% of Oregon and a portion of Southwest Washington. Before I introduce Rob, I would like to show you just a short 4-minute video to give you a sense of what Oregon Public Broadcasting is and does. And I'd like to introduce Kim Duncan.
Budget. I don't know whether that's the most relevant thing we can discuss here. The issue is the co-chairs have found the allocation and made it, and this will commit it to the counties. I absolutely sympathize and understand the frustration of my colleagues that haven't seen the budget. I keep pointing out that the interim committee, which met for 18 months, produced the budget and published it, and the president produced the budget, he published it, and that's the budget we're working off of. And there probably will be a budget that no one has yet seen because nobody sat down and made the negotiations that will produce the third version. And that's the synthesis between the governor's budget, the co-chair's budget, and that will probably happen after we're all fed up with being in here for another month or two. But the fact is that this $5 million has been allocated from sources within the general fund to this purpose, and that's what's on the table, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I'm again going to ask the audience if there's anyone that would like to give further testimony. If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on 5541. At the chair's request, we will not go into work session until our chair returns, and I will open the hearing on House Bill 5056.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Maynard Warren. I'm president of Oregon Public Broadcasting, and it is a pleasure to be here today. We appreciate the opportunity to talk about one of our favorite subjects, Oregon Public Broadcasting. With me is Rob Ball, who is the chairman of our OPB board, he's his senior partner and Ball Janet, and he will talk further on in this particular presentation. We're here to talk about what we do and how we do it, how well we do it, what it costs, and why the state partnership is crucial. We support the governor's recommended budget of $3.35 million for the biennium for Oregon Public Broadcasting, which represents about 10% of our overall operating budget. Just a little background. Oregon Public Broadcasting has been in existence since 1922, first as part of the Oregon System of Higher Education. In 1981, we moved to our own agency with the help of Ways and Means Chair then, Jack Ripper, and then in 1993 became a 501c3. Oregon Public Broadcasting consists of 5 television stations, 4 radio stations, and about 52 radio and TV translators covering about 90% of Oregon and a portion of Southwest Washington. Before I introduce Rob, I would like to show you just a short 4-minute video to give you a sense of what Oregon Public Broadcasting is and does. And I'd like to introduce Kim Duncan, our Vice President for Marketing and Communications, who will be doing that for us. As they say, it went all right the rest of the
yep.
time.
high desert to the Pacific Ocean, the halls of famous to the school halls, Oregon Public Broadcasting is strongly committed to tell Oregon stories.
I'm back in the saddle again. Out where a friend is a friend. Where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly chestnut.
This is Oregon Consider. I'm Morgan Holmes.
This is OTG News. I'm Beth Hyams. A stick out by
all of the bill.
We bring you fresh perspectives each week.
All these other states can't be completely
different.
And we take the time to dig deeper into complex issues.
And in a standards-based system, what we're trying to do is to set the bar at a level that we expect everybody to achieve. I think a lot of the issues that affect us are decided by the urban populations that really don't understand their ways that they are the world is.
We make a special effort to share the research and the challenges that make Oregon a special place.
These are sensitive moves. When they start feeling good, they're lost. Sesame Street is great fun, and that's the best way for them to learn. It's not something that they have to look at. It's something that they learn to watch. And when our teacher here will go back and say, do you remember the word or cookie monster we talked about number two? And they'll say, yes, they remember.
They have the one program called Fresh Air. It is fresh air. It's always new, a little different. Well, I think public broadcasting opens your mind to a lot of different points of view. I hear new things. I see things I've never seen before. I think I've just been much more appreciative of my world.
So why do you want to be almost 250,000 Oregon kids enriched by our preschool rental learning service each week? One of the nearly 100,000 students who use our college credit telecourses. Study and enjoy OTV Radio for its award-winning daily coverage of local news. Or you're one of the millions of Oregonians who treasure this statewide public service for your own unique reasons. We're proud to bring a world of learning to Oregonians from all over our state.
It's amazing how many stars there are. You know what's really amazing, Quail, is that recent discoveries within the Orion Nebula lend credence to the theory of a whole other solar system that predates our own, of course. Thus, increasing the chances of ours being alone.
There was just an article in the New York Times last week that lent further credence to planets out there and other solar systems. So, anyway, thanks for your indulgence on that. I'd like to now reintroduce Rob Ball, the senior partner of Ball Janik, who is our board member, our chair, who has a few words to say.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Ball. I'm just finishing in June my third year as chair of OPB's board of directors, and I think OPB is as closely connected to the state and the state's objectives as any state agency or any nonprofit organization in the state. As you know, we were a state agency until July 1st, 1993, when the legislature changed our status. They abolished at that point Oregon Public Broadcasting and transferred its assets to what we are today, a private nonprofit. and that gave OPB a lot of flexibility to meet challenges that we're facing throughout the United States in public broadcasting. But in July 93, it was never intended, I think, either by the state or by OPB, to completely sever the ties between OPB and the state. And just OPB was essentially a hybrid state agency or a state commission at that point, because we did receive both private and public funding, although we were a state institution. And we're still a hybrid not-for-profit. We still depend heavily on both private and public funding. And I think that dependency is unique among nonprofits in the state of Oregon. I think the only other nonprofit that's similar that I can think of is OHSU. Our bylaws are require us by statute to have five board members who are appointed by the governor. And our bylaws provide that the governor does appoint five members. We currently have five gubernatorial appointees on our board. The statute also expressly recognizes, I think you may have a copy of the statute in front of you, but the statute expressly recognizes a state obligation to continue to fund OPB and to continue a financial relationship and partnership with OPB. That statute is hard to find, but it's in Section 12, Chapter 208 of the 1993 session laws. And it says, quote, just a very small part of it, the state recognizes a continuing obligation to contribute to the support of a not-for-profit organization known as Oregon Public Broadcasting. The state recognizes that a continued financial partnership with OPB is essential to the preservation of statewide educational and public affairs programming services and broadcasting services for the disabled. State financial support for Oregon Public Broadcasting shall be directed to include but not be limited to the funding of these services. We're here today as asking you as our financial partner to continue to perform your role as financial partner. We're pleased that since 1993 we've been successful in increasing the amount of private funding for OPB, and we've been consciously attempting to decrease our reliance upon the state and upon federal government. And we intend to look primarily to our members, as we have in the past, and to our underwriters for continued support of OPB. But it's simply not realistic yet, and particularly today, to discontinue altogether the financial relationship we have with the state. As I mentioned to you, we have a board of 24 members. Our members come from throughout the state. Maynard, do you mind passing the board off here? And we spend a lot of time actively seeking to maintain geographic balance among our board membership, as well as diversities of skills and backgrounds. Our board roster, as you will see as you look at it, reflects people with backgrounds that are quite diverse in business and education, professions, public service, publishing, etc. But incidentally, there's really nothing politically partisan about our board, and quite to the contrary. Our board includes, for example, as you see on the roster, Tom Bergier, who ran unsuccessfully for the United States Senate against Gordon Smith, and also Charles Swindells, who was finance chairman for Gordon Smith in his race against Tom Bergier. In my 8 years on the board, there's never been an issue presented to the board or in discussion by the board in which party politics were relevant. All of us believe in the quality of what OPB is doing. And we all believe that OPB should continue to secure as much private funding as it can. And we all believe the state should continue to support OPB at reasonable levels as our ongoing financial partner, as the statute contemplates. I have one last comment to leave with you, and that is that you should know that OPB is extremely well managed. It's an institution of the highest quality. And if you are in Portland, I invite you to a tour, to come by OPB, take a tour of the facilities, and let us show you what we're doing. We think our supporters get their money's worth in contributing to OPB, and we think the state would get its money's worth by continuing its partnership with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. I'd like to take you now through some boards which reflect a little bit about Oregon Public Broadcasting. Our mission statement reflects both our obligations to develop content and to distribute, to enhance lifetime learning by being a top producer and provider of high-quality educational and informational programs. I just want to take a minute to explain why those two things are important. If you have a content development arm and no distribution, you may not be able to get the distribution that you want. When you have both, you can not only produce content, but also show it in appropriate venues. And since we have about 99% of all of our audience and owns a television set or a radio set, we have that capability. And you might know that Warner Brothers and Disney and General Electric have paid billions of dollars for that, and we have it at no cost through our FCC licenses. Our OTT services are very broad. Just to give you an example, on the television side, we produce a fair number of local program specials. We cover the gamut in science, public affairs, children's programs, college credit programs, GED on TV, and have been doing that for years and will continue to do it for years. Our radio resources include a daily newscast and many local news programs, including the City Club, Washington County Forum, Newsmakers Forum, which I hope you all listen to, because I think some of you may have even appeared on that program. Golden Hour is our radio reading service for the blind and the homebound. We sponsor 50 to 60 events of other nonprofit organizations per year, and those media sponsorships, they're very deep within our organization and function both in radio, television, and other venues for OPB, are valued at about $15,000 for each sponsorship that we do for those other organizations. With a backbone for the Oregon Emergency Alert System, AES, which we hope to continue, and through schools and federal grants and other funds that we raise through membership and other support, we offer a fairly wide range of school resources and wish we could do more. Of course, with the new media, we've opened up lots of services on the Internet and our website, which has been very important to us in terms of not only developing new listeners and viewers, but also giving people an alternative way to get information. We've just won several radio awards, and the scripts of the radio programs are on our website, and so we just want to continue to provide that kind of access for people. Just our top 10 benchmarks, we've listed a few of them. We have many more than this, but I think it's a good list. Oregonians rank OPB and libraries as their most valued cultural resources. And last year, the Oregonian did a poll and ranked OPB as through a survey as the favorite media outlet. We're ranked right at the top in terms of per capita viewing on television, always have been since they've kept statistics. About 55% of all Oregons watch us or listen to us each week, about 85% each month. Our radio audience, and I think a lot of this is focused on our growth in news and information programs, which seem to be of more interest to people these days, has grown about six times in the last 10 years. We have one of the very highest membership penetrations in the nation, so I think we're doing a very good job there. As a matter of fact, we're seeing that beginning to slope off now, not only at OPB, but around the country. What we are seeing, though, is the same number of individuals giving more money per year, so that's been helpful. Again, we publish a newsletter that reaches about 30,000 teachers a month. We perform lots of instructional services in the field for migrants, as you noticed. That through a federal grant and through our own station support. About 200,000 children a week watch OPB children's programs in about 10,000 classrooms. Oregon Field Guide is still consistently the most watched, locally produced public television program in the nation. We're very proud of that. This is its 10th year. And in March of 1997, because we knew we couldn't move as fast as the commercial broadcasters, we were able to pull together a series of corporations who gave us equipment to put Oregon's first digital transmitter on the air, and we used that to help corporations and manufacturers use our signal for their own testing purposes as they develop product. So just a little bit on our television service. We run 40% of our broadcast day for children's programs. I know most of you may not know that because you're at work during that time, but it's a huge part of our broadcast day. Our informal and formal education is 23%, 24% in arts, sciences, and humanities, and you can see the programs that we offer there, and 13% for news and public affairs. So, again, we'll talk a little bit more about digital later, but that will also allow us to do even more in some of these areas. On OPB Radio, I don't know about you, but I start my day with OPB Radio, and weekends it's pretty much on all the time. It's the only decent source of news and information about our country and our world that has depth and consistency. Again, I want to emphasize, as Mr. Ball said, that our job is not to provide a point of view, but to provide several ideas and points of view for people to ingest and figure out what their particular perspective is. That's our job. And we're very proud of the work that our local staff does, too, in OPB Radio. At this point, I'd like to bring up Bill Swindells, who is the vice chair of our board and will be our chair starting July 1st. He is the president of Clackamas Review. So, Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here today. I'm Bill Swindells. I wanted to touch on mostly on the development activities of the volunteers and the staff at Oregon Public Broadcasting, as well as what some of the effects that I think that OPB has on the families and the citizens of Oregon. For every dollar that we receive from the state, we generally leverage that into $8 of private money and another dollar from the federal government. That is an impressive leverage, I think. It shows how hard we're working not to be dependent on the state, as Rob made the point, but to become as diverse in our funding as possible. About one out of every six of our viewers and listeners is a contributor to OPB. That means that about five out of six of the people we reach kind of get to have a free ride. As well as we are supported, we reach and serve a much broader constituency. That constituency is not necessarily uniform across, geographically uniform across the state. We probably receive a predominance of our private money from the Portland metro area while we're serving listeners and viewers all over the state. For that reason, I think it's appropriate that the state government give us some assistance in funding as we are providing our services to a great number of people throughout the state that their communities are not necessarily able or capable of supporting the service they're getting. I wanted to speak to what I think the benefits to individuals and families are. These have been covered in some bullet points previously. I don't think there's any greater educational benefit to preschool children. I am a father of four. They're my children's almost entire pre-K development was from Oregon Public Broadcasting. I think if you watch commercial television nowadays, you know that you cannot rely on that as the proper content that you want children to have to be their sole source of impression. I also feel very strongly about the value of OPB in terms of independent journalism. I have an embarrassing confession to make. I was channel surfing the other night, and I watched the last 10 minutes of Ally McBeal. During Ally McBeal, they came on to do the promo for the Fox News at 10. The lead story of Fox News was to follow the careers of the dynamic characters of Ally McBeal. That's the local Fox News at 10. I don't think I'm certain there is no other news service in the state of Oregon that is covering the state as an entity. I think local media is very fixed on either very local content or national world content, which they can purchase very cheaply. That though some people complain they may not always agree with the content that they hear on public broadcasting, I think I want you to appreciate the value of genuinely independent journalism. Back to the education, we have thousands of teachers download course content off of our service. I also wanted to emphasize that while some people feel that there are new commercial alternatives for our documentary content, the Learning Channel or the Discovery Channel, I think if you pay attention, you notice that most of what they show was produced originally for public broadcasting because there was no commercial support for that programming when it was developed. And they have then taken it and edited it as a commercially viable product. But if we relied on the commercial sector to develop our documentary materials, we wouldn't see the breadth and depth of information that we have now. Those are my formal remarks.
Okay, thank you very much, Bill. I'd like to continue with the chart here for just a brief moment to give you a background on the revenue sources for Oregon Public Broadcasting and how they've changed over the years.
Other questions, Senator Braille?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I listened to Oregon Public Broadcasting and watched the television specials. I listened to the news broadcast and I listened to the radio, and I enjoy it. But I guess I don't really hear the diversity of opinion that you're describing. I hear a variety, but not a diversity. I hear a lot of different sources, but they're pretty predictable in content. And I just wondered if you could talk about the diversity as you see it.
I was just going to try to say earlier that Rush Limbaugh is on KGW. So you can just like flip over there and get the diversity.
I have some precepts, so if I could...
Chairman Messler, Senator Perioli, thanks for your question. Again, we do not espouse any particular point of view. I think if you listen to our radio service or watch our television service over the period of a week, you will see a great diversity of opinion, whether you listen or watch the McLaughlin Report or listen to the NewsHour or listen to Oregon Considered or Morning Edition. From my perspective, as a person who is admittedly in the middle of the road, I like what I hear, and I think that the diversity of opinion is strong. I don't think you will hear as often the very far right or the very far left as you will hear more comments that tend to reflect, I think, the mainstream of America, but I think you certainly hear those if you listen to us on a regular basis. But I don't know what hours you listen, so it would be hard for me to make a judgment for you about that. Again, one of the beauties of the human race is that we all have our own perceptions and perceive things from our perspective, which is what makes us so interesting. But other than that, I don't know what else I could comment on.
Mr. Chairman, actually, my question has a lot to do with the observations of the speaker, not my observations. I just basically said I hear a lot of variety, not a lot of diversity. And I think the content of OPB is excellent, but it's pretty predictable. And I guess as far as the chairman is standing in the middle of the road, you're likely to get run over when you're standing in the middle of the road.
Chairman, that's what Senator Perioli. I hear a great deal of diversity. I don't know if you listen to Fresh Air or not. The guests on that program are hugely diverse and come from a wide range of our culture. So I guess I don't hear it the way you hear it.
Mr. Chairman, I said diverse, not bizarre. I do listen to Gary Gross on Fresh Air, but I would consider that more than diverse. That's diverse plus, I think, Mr. Chairman.
I think, Senator Perioli, that maybe you're looking at the wrong time view.
So that's like you're walking up to the 7-Eleven and finding it closed and then tapping on the window and asking if that's your open 24 hours, and the guy saying, well, not in a row. So I look at the program guide, and I really do not see the, as the representative, me, Senator Leonard pointed out, that Rush Limbaugh is on another channel. I think that's probably so.
Chairman Messerly, Senator Perioli, I also want to point out that the majority of our television day is not news and public affairs. It is children's programming, science. So I look at that as part of our obligation to be diverse. And in that 13% that you see on television that's news and public affairs, I think the job that we do does present a wide range of view. I guess you and I will probably just agree to disagree on that, but I'd love to continue our conversation.
Mr. Chairman, I won't take more of
this
committee's time. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We do appreciate it.
Sure.
Chair, I have one question. Yes. When you're talking about the divorce, do you have any programs for the minorities, which we have a 12% total population of our state as other minorities? What chances are they are going to continue to grow? Any particular that the programs or pensions on those minority people?
Chairman Messerly, Senator Lim, yes, we do. They aren't necessarily specific programs like an Asian hour or a Korean hour or a Chinese hour or a Russian hour or a Jewish hour or something like that. But what we have are strands of our diverse culture interwoven in our programming. And if you listen, as an example, to our radio service, you hear, I believe, a wide variety points of view from diverse cultures. As an example, I think Oregon Public Radio does more to serve the knowledge of the world through its reporters in Africa and Japan and China and the Middle East and Europe than any other radio service in America. So what you have to do, I think, is to really listen to us and hear the fabric of our comment built into programs like Oregon Considered and All Things Considered. And that's what we basically do. Just a brief comment on the evolution of our revenue sources. As you can see, in the early 80s, about 42% of our budget was state funding. In a 10-year period, it reduced to about 24%, and then in this last year, was 10%. By the way, these are handouts that you have that you have to look at to refresh your memory in case you have any additional questions on this. That represents a decrease in actual dollars over the last 20 years. We are actually asking for less money by far than we did in 81. Now, if we could have the next board. Our revenue this year shows 52%.
The guy saying, well, not in a row. I look at the program guide and I really do not see the, as a representative, me, Senator Leonard pointed out, that Rush Limbaugh is on another channel. I think that's probably so.
Chairman Messerly, Senator Ferrioli, I also want to point out that the majority of our television day is not news and public affairs. It is children's programming, science, so I look at that as part of our obligation to be diverse. And in that 13% that you see on television, that's news and public affairs, I think the job that we do does present a wide range of view. I guess you and I will probably just agree to disagree on that, but I'd love to continue our conversation.
Mr. Chairman, I won't take more of this committee's time. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We do appreciate it.
Sure.
I have one question. Did you have questions?
Yes.
When you're talking about the diverse, do you have any programs for the minorities, which we have a 12% total population of our state are the minorities? The chances are they are going to continue to grow. Any particular the programs or pensions on those minority people?
Chairman Messerly, Senator Lim, yes, we do. They aren't necessarily specific programs like an Asian hour or a Korean hour or a Chinese hour or a Russian hour or a Jewish hour or something like that. But what we have are strands of our diverse culture interwoven in our programming. And if you listen, as an example, to our radio service, you hear, I believe, a wide variety of points of view from diverse cultures. As an example, I think Oregon Public Radio does more to serve the knowledge of the world through its reporters in Africa and Japan and China and the Middle East and Europe than any other radio service in America. So what you have to do, I think, is to really listen to us and hear the fabric of our comment built into programs like Oregon Considered and All Things Considered. And that's what we basically do. Just a brief comment on the evolution of our revenue sources. As you can see, in the early 80s, about 42% of our budget was state funding. In a 10-year period, it reduced to about 24%, and then in this last year, was 10%. By the way, these are handouts that you have that you have to look at to refresh your memory in case you have any additional questions on this. That represents a decrease in actual dollars over the last 20 years. We are actually asking for less money by far than we did in 81. Now, if we could have the next board. Our revenue this year shows 52% member-driven, and this represents about 110,000 members that give us an average of somewhere between $70 and $80 a year. What this does not reflect are two aspects of our budget. One is all the national and international production we do. Those monies are not built into our operating budget and run anywhere from $2 to $5 million a year. That's our money in, money out, and we hire independent producers and project people to develop those programs for us. Nor does it reflect our capital campaign, which we are in the middle of, which is $27.5 million, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. As you can see, a portion of underwriting business is 11%. Sales and services, which is a figure that has grown greatly in the last 10 years, is a reflection of our role in producing content, not only locally, but nationally and internationally with partners. Okay? In comparing our revenue sources to other state networks, you can see that in terms of per capita, Oregon Public Broadcasting is on the very bottom. And Arkansas is on the very top with $12 per capita, and we're at 50 cents. And we're third from the bottom in terms of actual dollars. Both Idaho and North Dakota are smaller, but of course they have smaller populations. Then I want to show you a picture of our service. Let's see. Okay, we have next our digital television. Do we have the service area map too? Just to, I know we're talking about this briefly, but this represents over 100 different FCC licenses that we need to apply for and maintain. It includes our 39 television translators, our 14 radio translators, our 5 TV stations, our 4 radio stations, and about 30 microwave sites that encompass our network. And the reason I show this is that the money that we're requesting is aimed primarily at preserving this network. Okay. Now, I want to take just a minute before I close to talk about our digital future, because the revolution in technology is hitting us right between the eyes. The Federal Communications Commission has required that we convert to digital technology by 2003. In the Portland area, because it's in the top 30 markets, all the commercial stations in Portland have to convert by November of this year. And just a little aside, in the top 10 markets, they have to convert by next month. So in order to be there with the commercial stations, we began a capital campaign over 3 years ago and have raised $8 million from the private sector of the 27.5 that we need to do our total conversion. Now remember, this is not replacing the existing analog system. This is building a separate entity, a separate digital service. So in effect, we're going to have two OPBs. Now we're not asking for money for that at this particular time. We're really dealing with operating budget. But I just wanted you to know that at some time, hopefully, we will be wanting to chat with you about perhaps a role that the state could play in this digital transition. It's hugely costly, but what it does for us on the other side is allow us to develop more program streams which would meet the needs of people who currently can only see one program on OPB during a specific time. This is just an example, not to be held my feet to the fire on this, but just an example of what it might look like in tomorrow's digital television world. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but this is just one of many configurations that we could possibly have. Including running some audio on our digital television service or even providing worldwide teleconferencing services. And the advantage of that is that we're in every home so that people wouldn't have to go anywhere to get those services. And we're looking at that. Today you see our service. This is a possible service tomorrow. And I can tell you that public broadcasting is developing a children's channel which will be on the air in the new digital time frame of September of 99. We will offer on our digital service a full-blown 24-hour-a-day children's town. This is the most fascinating time, and I would certainly encourage any questions that you might have, because there are no dumb questions in digital technology. None of us know enough to be very smart in this area. Just in conclusion, I just want to reiterate that OPB covers 90% of all Oregonians for free over-the-air educational broadcasting services, regardless of where they live. This is not duplicated by commercial broadcasters. And over 60% of our broadcast day is devoted to direct education for preschool teachers and college students. This also is not duplicated by commercial broadcasters who really struggle to even provide 3 hours a week of FCC-mandated educational programming, which I don't think, by and large, is very educational.
Absent our state support for the engineering and transmission, our services would be delivered unequally to Oregonians, and we probably have to concentrate more of that, those services in the Portland area. I mentioned our role as the emergency alert system, and that's a very important function for us in case of emergencies or disasters, and this is also a service to our commercial college. One other thing I want to mention is that where we can save money, we certainly do. And on the digital spectrum, we have developed a partnership with KGW Channel 8 in Portland to co-own and co-build a new digital tower with them, saving us over $1.5 million. And we will be, we'll be a limited liability corporation with equal partnership. So we're very pleased about that and very pleased that BLO Broadcasting has consented to include us on their land. With that, let me just close and urge your support of our modest request and open this up for questions. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do we have any questions of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, question for the administrator. The bill that we have, the 5056, is, doesn't list the agencies or the amounts. It's a blank bill that relates, relating to financial administration and appropriating.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the appropriation for Oregon Public Broadcasting was included in House Bill 5048 along with the money for Oregon Health Sciences University and Oregon Historical Society. I have had counsel to send amendments to time of house to distribute that shows the amount that will be the amount that Mr. Orm has talked about, $3,350,509 for Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Will there be other amendments to 5056?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, if the committee decides to amend it, there will be an additional bid.
Mr. Chair, the relating clause looks suspiciously like a Christmas tree bill, and I'm curious to know what this is.
Mr. Chairman, the committee, it is a blank leave means bill that is used for. It has been used, I'm sure, for the Christmas tree bill in previous years and other financial related matters that the committee or the assembly needs to consider.
Are there any other comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two more people who would like to testify. Denise Matthews. Would you like to testify? And also, there's a name here with us that they can't read from Eugene. It looks like Steve or
Michael Warren Steve.
Steve, that looks maybe right. Did
you Tom Chandler on there as well?
No, I did not.
Mr. Chairman, is this a public hearing?
Yes.
Is there a sign up sheet asked?
Yes. There was. Do we have some more sign ups?
My name is Tom Chamberlain, and I had the posted permission for 20 minutes, and yesterday I read the names of Denise and Lauren to testify with me, but somehow my name hasn't come up yet.
Mr. Chamberlain, that you did speak to me. Mr. Chamberlain did speak to me, but that is the sheet that was placed over on the corner at the beginning of the day.
Oh.
And I'm sorry, I didn't know you.
Oh.
But yes, Mr. Chamberlain did contact me about the line system.
Okay, and you have other folks who are going to
testify? The three of us had comments to make, yes, and we had requested 20 minutes. I hope we don't lose that much of your time.
Okay. We are running a little bit short. I have one other hearing that I have to conduct today, so before we begin.
Love to pass out some materials here. I came down and had some remarks prepared, and what I wanted to start out talking about was the importance to this community of telling our stories to one another, of knowing who we are, where we come from, why we're here, what we're about. And I think that OPV did a very persuasive job in their 4-minute videotape of I noticed everybody laughing and being quite engaged with the stories that were about Oregon. Now,
the problem that happens is that while that videotape is very persuasive, when you look at that yellow piece of paper here, you'll see that out of the total programming prime time schedule, if you take any week, you won't, with maybe one or two exceptions, come up with more than 3.6% of the actual programming time spent on Oregon culture, Oregon issues, and Oregon stories. Now, there are broadcasting systems throughout this country that give as much as 18% of their time to the stories that are important to the state. And over the last 3 years, a group of us have worked very hard to try to persuade the management both of the kinds of stories that there are out there and their value to the community. We've also tried to persuade them of the extraordinary creative community that is out there to help them do this. Well, while there has been interest and talk, we've never really gotten a commitment from them. Now, on the blue chunk of my proposal here, you'll have the opportunity to look at what some other states are doing. This Kentucky celebrating the heritage of Commonwealth through profiles of people, their places, and their ideas. The red piece of paper, about 3 years ago, as I say, we engaged with OPB in this discussion. A man by the name of John Lindsay was vice president of production at that time. And after about a year meeting, John came up with what he called the local vision, draft two. And John is a very fine producer who worked in Minnesota for years producing programming for the stations in Minnesota about local circumstances. If you look down on the number three on that first page, John mentions the numbers. Rose City Remembered, the Oregon Story, two shows produced for fundraising at OPB, and those are produced because more people watch them and more people send in, become members. Now, our point is that there really is not only a need, but as I travel around the state, I talk to people who just don't feel like they're a part of Oregon culture, who just don't feel. They feel like that Oregon is Metro Portland, and even though Oregon Field Guide is a wonderful show, it doesn't really speak to the things that we share as a state. I mean, here we are with the state of Washington. We share the Columbia River. We have our juvenile justice system, our schools, our government. These are all things that we should be talking to one another about on a regular basis. The yellow piece are a couple of letters from producers around the state. There's also a list in the back of some 150 people who are producers and artists, directors who would love to participate in telling Oregon's story in its in all of its complexity. And I can see that I'm there. I'm going to stop.
Could you relate this to the budget, which is what we're looking
at? Yes, I can relate it to the budget. I think that you folks have a unique opportunity by saying this appropriation should really be earmarked for production about Oregon, and that would be the bottom line for me. Thank you very much.
Would Matthews and Mr.
I'll say it again.
Sears, would you like to come up and sit down too, sir?
Thank you for letting me speak to you. My name is Denise Matthews. I'm a professor, assistant professor at the University of Oregon. I teach video production, documentary production, and visual communications to students from all over the state. And I'm here today to speak on behalf of local programming, the importance of local programming. And I also need to mention to you that I've had a lot of experience in PBS affiliates all over the country. I'm fairly new to Oregon. and I've worked in Connecticut Public Television. I've worked for WGBH in Boston, Maryland Public Television, and I know that since the 70s, local programming in the country that's been produced by PBS has gone down from 12% in the 70s, and it's now about 4% in the 90s, and that's pretty typical, and that's also what's happened here in Oregon. However, I was happy when I came to Oregon to see that there is a strong commitment and interest in increasing the local programming, and I wanted to tell you that from the vantage point of teaching the young people of Oregon who are learning the skills to be able to tell the stories, that we've developed a wonderful collaboration with OPB. Tom Doggett, who's the Vice President of Programming at OPB, put a lot of effort into developing a conduit for student work to be shown on OPB. Students are now producing short historical documentaries about all parts of the state. Heppner, there's one on the Heppner flood. There's one about the founding of North Bend. Wonderful pieces, but they're really strongly informed by these young local producers who come to the topic really infused with knowledge about their locale, about their part of Oregon, and they are so well equipped to tell the stories. Once we give them the skills, they're out there, and they really want to get their point of view on OPB, their perspective from their part of the state. And we love the collaboration we now have with OPB, but I want to encourage an even broader collaboration that will allow these young people to talk about social issues as well, not just history, but also the social issues that affect them. We know that we need to hear our young people. We're not hearing them. We have a problem in this country. This is a wonderful conduit for allowing people that are young, who are gaining these skills, to give their perspectives and air them on our only statewide broadcast system, OPB. I'm very encouraged that this will happen in the state. I just took a trip through Eastern Oregon, my first time. I'm just stunned by the vastness of the state, the small towns. I want to hear their voices. I need to know them. I don't want to just have the perspective of Willamette Valley, and I think that the whole state deserves to develop a discourse that is aired on OPB. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Let's see, Mr. Matthews?
My name is Lauren Sears.
I'm sorry, Sears.
Uh-huh.
Sears.
I have a long, lifelong history of experience in film and television, from production to teaching to station operations management and building facilities as well. I'm here today representing a group called Friends of Public Broadcasting, which is a statewide consortium of viewers, community groups, and producers of television who are working to bring locally relevant programming to the Oregon Public Broadcasting. I wanted to basically speak for the governmental position that public television has had over the years, and very briefly, as Maynard has mentioned, OPB was, in fact, a part of the state up to 6 years ago. In that tradition, the Carnegie Commission, who wrote the founding documents for public broadcast system in the United States, the Congress of the United States, who has implemented these in law, and then in the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, who has the dispersal powers of the money and the policies and so on that enabled, all mandated that there be local cultural services provided to the communities served by the broadcasters in public television and radio. Our exception, I think, to what OPB is currently doing, because they do so many things well in so many ways, is local programming. And the other issue, I think, is true public oversight of the situation. Basically, since OPB went public left the state 6 years ago, they became a private nonprofit corporation. And while the governor does appoint 5 of the 24 board members, the others are essentially self-electing. What we have under economic pressures and corporate pressures that have centralized control of all media has been effective on OPB, and we've seen a very much of a of a, well, I would say a privatization of the media. They've had to survive. But it takes them farther and farther away from what the original public mandate of public television is. If I could just quote, this Corporation for Public Broadcasting, founded by Carnegie Commission, said, public television programming can deepen the sense of community in local life. It should bring into the home meetings, now generally untelevised, such as this one perhaps, where major public decisions are hammered out. But occasions also where people of the community express their hope, their protests, their enthusiasms, and their wills. And that means a broad diversity of them, too, not just a small compartmentalization of opinions and will. It should provide a voice for groups in the community that may otherwise be unheard. Now, this is part of the vision, and this is the thing that tends to get lost. As business becomes more difficult for public broadcasting, as other pressures, too broad for me to go into at this point, I'm sure you're aware of them anyway. They're on everybody in our lives these days, every institution, every corporation. But what we have to look out for is the public interest, and that's why we're speaking to you as the representatives of the public interest and the apportioners of the public's money. We need to have public broadcasting of, by, and about Oregonians on Oregon Public Broadcasting. Generally, it does not find an adequate place in their budget, and very little of it is done. What you see on your table are very distinct specials. Three of those videotapes were produced only because the Department of Agriculture came up with the money to pay for them. I don't have a number, but I would think it's quite small what the actual production of this type of documentary is throughout the year of OPB programming. Again, the economics are not there for them to do certain kinds of programming. Also, I think the flexibility in their outlook is not there to make use of other types of programming and ways of airing the state's concerns that are not made by them. They have a pretty expensive rate card in-house. There are lots of other ways of using student work, of using independent producers who are already producing work elsewhere in the state, who could cut out a 10-minute segment for an Oregon magazine show. That would be vastly cheaper than the $30,000 per show spent on, say, Oregon Field Guide. So, needing to have the flexibility in what they're willing to do, the willing to experiment and discover ways that they can serve people in Oregon, use the talent that's in the state, both in professionally and in our upcoming students, try and tie the education going on in the universities to the money being spent on television so they work together. And look out for the public interest here. What I wanted to make a note is, 96% of the prime time programming from the hours of 7 to 11 on OPB is imported programming. It comes from outside of Oregon. 25% of it comes from outside the country. That's British. These numbers vary a little bit depending on which week you choose to slice, and this was kind of a pseudo-random grasp of the week. We analyzed this, and these are the numbers that we came up with. You could take a different week and get some slightly different percentages. But in any case, the local Oregon production consists of two half-hours, one of which is Field Guide, which really only runs for 13 weeks of the year out of 52, so we're watching reruns for some part of that year, too. But those two programs, as original programming, would only take up 3.6% of the programming. We have $15 million annual budget at OPB, and somewhere in the neighborhood, maybe 2.5% of that is spent on Oregon production, Oregon programming. There's been several other criticisms of OPB that have to do with inflexibility towards people who bring in programming that is already made, that could be shown for free. Again, several issues about what is the culture that we're serving here. You know, we're talking about the grassroots culture, the life in the communities of all over the state, from Ashland to Enterprise and from Seaside to Burns Junction. A vast complexity, and we need to see and know each other. That's one of the rights and privileges of public television. If you take that away, there is none. Quality programming can be bought elsewhere. And supplying programming that only the market will pay for which is primarily what accomplishes the 53% of viewer support of the programming. Essentially, the programming is put up for barter. If you pay for this, we'll show it. Well, that's fine if that's a private interest concern, but as a public institution, the public's interest has to be spoken for. That's who you people represent. That's who we try and bring into our coalition as well. We're a coalition of viewers, of community groups, and of producers capable of serving both those communities. What we're trying to do is to make a liaison with OPB so that they allow the talent and resources we have to serve the state. Now, what does this mean to you? What we're asking for is that you give OPB $3.35 million. $5 million I would have you give if it were up to me. But what we're asking for is that 3.35 amount be earmarked for production by, for, and about Oregonians. That public money be earmarked to go to the public's most obvious good programming for, by, and about them. We also ask you to reaffirm that OPB does have a public programming responsibility that goes beyond simply showing the most popular programming. That there is a life in our state that we need to be in touch with. This, as Denise said, is the only network that, the only programming that needs to be in touch with. This should be a basic way that the people of Oregon know each other. You know, wherever you all are from, I'm from someplace else, and we need to know who we are. I need to hear that your sympathy is important to you, and vice versa. This is the medium to do it. And so we're asking that you reaffirm the obligation towards public programming by, for, and about Oregonians on OPB. And we're asking also that in future considerations of funding, that you assess the progress that OPB makes in public broadcasting service of, for, and about Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Steers. Let's see. We've got to be mindful of the time. We've got testimony relative to Bill 5503 which can only be given today, but we do have one further testimony on Bill 5056, and that's Garrett Lindbergh.
Good afternoon. This is my first time speaking before the legislation. Excuse me for...
And, again, several issues about what is the culture that we're serving here. You know, we're talking about the grassroots culture, the life in the communities of all over the state, from Ashland to Enterprise and from Seaside to Burns Junction. A vast complexity, and we need to see and know each other. That's one of the rights and privileges of public television. If you take that away, there is none. Quality programming can be bought elsewhere. And supplying programming that only the market will pay for, which is primarily what accomplishes the 53% of viewer support of the programming, is essentially the programming is put up for barter. If you pay for this, we'll show it. Well, that's fine if that's a private interest concern, but as a public institution, the public's interest has to be spoken for. That's who you people represent. That's who we try and bring into our coalition as well. We're a coalition of viewers, of community groups, and of producers capable of serving both those communities. What we're trying to do is to make a liaison with OPB so that they allow the talent and resources we have to serve the state. Now, what does this mean to you? What we're asking for is that you give OPB $3.35 million. $5 million I would have you give if it were up to me. But what we're asking for is that 3.35 amount be earmarked for production by, for, and about Oregonians. That public's money be earmarked to go to the public's most obvious good, programming for, by, and about them. We also ask you to reaffirm that OPB does have a public programming responsibility that goes beyond simply showing the most popular programming, that there is a life in our state that we need to be in touch with. This, as Denise said, is the only network, that the only programming that reaches the entire state. This should be a basic way that the people of Oregon know each other. You know, wherever you all are from, I'm from someplace else, and we need to know who we are. I need to hear that your industry is as important to you, and vice versa. This is the medium to do it. And so we're asking that you reaffirm the obligation towards public programming by, for, and about Oregonians on OPB. And we're asking also that in future considerations of funding, that you assess the progress the OPB makes in public broadcasting service of, for, and about Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Spears. Let's see. We've got to be mindful of the time. We've got testimony relative to Bill 5503, which can only be given today, but we do have one further testimony on Bill 5056, and that's Garrett Lindbergh.
Good afternoon. This is my first time speaking before the legislation, so you'll have to excuse me for not knowing the proper protocol and such. I'm an independent business owner.
What is your name and where you're from?
Yes, my name is Garrett Lindbergh. I'm from Beaverton.
Thank
you. I own and operate a multimedia development business, independent contractor. I have no kids. I'm single. I vote pretty much independent. I voted for Tip Topper and Dole, so that kind of shows my spectrum of political beliefs. I've been a supporter of public broadcasting for probably 15 years or so. I've lived all over the country and have continually supported it, and even here as well. About 2 years ago, I did start my own business, and in such, I was working on developing a new television show pilot. Contacted OPB, and the program manager at that time was rude, to say it politely, and even expressing any kind of consideration for listening to my idea and such. About that time, they also changed the radio programming and stated that they had contacted Oregonians and voted in this direction and such. I contacted people and found out that they actually did not contact as many people as they said they had and decided to do this pretty much on their own decision-making. Based on this and my view of looked like a lot of corporate money was going in their direction, I decided that it wasn't anything I wanted to be associated with anymore. Given that information, you probably think that I'm here to say you shouldn't give that money to OPB. Actually, the contrary is true. After a period of time of not listening or watching OPB, I noticed that my involvement in the community and real knowledge of what was going on at both a local level and national level had dropped off considerably. As I started listening to the radio station and watching the programming, I saw that I actually really enjoyed the information they provided, and it was at a global level, and it was more in-depth and better programming than what existed on any of the other stations and such. I also saw that I increased my volunteerism to the community, and in doing so, I'm going to be a volunteer at OPB taking calls for funding and such, and that's how I found out about this, just by coincidence. They were not aware of my coming here, nor support or my being here in any way. So I really speak as an independent person. I don't have any kids, but I do have a number of friends and family that do have kids, and do see the value in which they supply in that direction as well. I believe they do have a ways to go, but I am impressed that they have reduced their funding from a state component and they continue to improve upon themselves. And I feel the best way for me to make changes there is to become more involved in what's going on. I like the idea that the money be earmarked for local purposes and such, and look for some more discussion on that as well. I just feel that I represent just an individual out there that supports what they're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Lundberg. Other questions for Mr. Lundberg? Thank you very kindly.
Thank you.
Chris? Yeah.
So I have a couple moments just to correct you. You bet. If you would please come forward and identify for the record.
Again, Maynard Horn, president of Oregon Public Broadcasting. I just got about six corrections to make here. Oregon Public Broadcasting last year spent $1.6 million on local production. We involved 52 local independent producers in that work. Number two, on our national international production side, we currently have about 140 projects in development. 90% of those are with independent producers. Number three, Tom Chamberlain mentioned Kentucky as having a higher percentage of local production. Yes, they do. Their state also gives them $18 million per year as opposed to the $1.6 million a year we get. So that's one of the reasons why that percentage is higher. Number four, if we were to take every program hour that we run and produce it locally, those costs would be about $400 to $600 million a year, depending on how much you put in. Our budget is a little over $15 million a year. So therefore, we have to buy programs from other sources. There's no way we could survive without it. Currently, the 4% that they quoted that we use for local, which includes our spaces between programs as well, that costs us about four times more to produce than buying the other 96% of the program. So that gives you a sense of the economic issues there. Last night, I wish you could have watched the Merrill Report, because it was an hour devoted to children telling their stories about their lives and about violence in school. So we do our very best to find those programs that, while they might not be local programs always, certainly represent and respect a local perspective, vision, and ideas to our Oregonians here that help raise the level of the conversation. And one other thought, the level of local production that we produce is about the same as we did about 12 years ago. So we haven't either increased or decreased. It's about the same. But I can tell you, I agree with those gentlemen. We would love to be able to do some more local programs and programs about Oregon if we could find the funds to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horn. Because of the time constraints, I'm going to go ahead and extend the public hearing and work session, possible work session for House Bill 5056 until tomorrow. And we'll open now the public hearing portion of Senate Bill 5503, the Capital Planning Commission. So we'd like to invite forward, please, representing the Capital Planning Commission, let's see, Mr. Myers. Carl Myers. I hope we've left enough time to go ahead, Mr. Myers. I understand you won't be in town tomorrow.
That's correct. I might be available later tomorrow, early afternoon, mid-afternoon, but if you want to hear this at 1 o'clock, I may be unavailable. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Myers. The chair of the Capital Planning Commission. Many of you have seen me in these hall and howls because in my professional practice, I do represent a number of groups in front of the as part of the legislative process. But in real life, I am lawyer here in town and chair of the Capital Planning Commission as a public member, and am here to speak on behalf of the Capital Planning Commission, answer any questions you may have about what we do or our budgetary process. I think most of the presentation ought to come from the Executive Director, Mr. Doug Cass, who is familiar with not only the budget, but also our operations. And so most of the presentation will come from him. In fact, I'll turn the podium over to him at this point.
Thank you very much, Mr. Myers.
Oh, and may I add, Mr. Chair, that Representative Mannix wanted to be here to speak on behalf of our budget and the work of the Capital Planning Commission. He's tied up in a meeting at this point and will get here as soon as he can, or may speak to you individually outside the hearing process.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thought maybe what I would do, particularly if there are new members of this committee that aren't quite as familiar with the Capital Planning Commission, is just do a quick overview of what our role and function is. I was thinking that if the OPB presentation was made with their videos and nice flip charts and so forth, that perhaps the best way to describe, at least historically, what we've done would be for you to grab an umbrella and walk from the Capitol up to D Street and see the development of the Capitol Mall, because that, in fact, is where the Capitol Planning Commission began. Formed in 1949, it was generated out of an organization called the State Capitol Reconstruction Commission. So you can imagine what that was about. That was when this building, or the predecessor building, burned. And there was some sense that there ought to be a orderly plan of development for the Capitol Mall. And we've also discovered in our historical research that there was a long-range planning commission that was set up by the Salem Chamber of Commerce. And those two functions merged together in 1949 to form the Capitol Planning Commission. And its primary objective at that time, and for years, was to preserve state land for the creation of the Capitol Mall. And it was made up of the governor and the legislative leadership and city leadership, and early minutes indicate that the goal was to, quote, secure areas from commercial and industrial encroachment. What that really meant was, as state government was beginning to expand up the Capitol Mall, that no one wanted a Sears store or a auto repair place or something like that to sort of get in the middle of the orderly progression of state buildings as they were expanding. In the early years, then, the preservation of land was really the Capitol Planning Commission's primary goal. But as time went on, other areas of state government, state facilities, were placed under the Capitol Planning Commission's jurisdiction. So currently, and over time, currently the Capitol Planning Commission has jurisdiction over state properties within Marion and Polk County. So not only was then the Capitol Planning Commission's role to preserve state land, but also to play a significant role in the orderly plan of development of and around these major facilities, the state hospital, the state penitentiary, and so forth. So statutory language was added in the commission's history to establish and effectuate a long-range plan of development of the areas around state buildings in the Salem area. So this statutory change that occurred years ago evolved into a different role for the commission. So when preservation of land became less important, actually how the land was used became a higher priority. So the second goal of the commission from that time on is to be concerned with the impact of state facilities on neighborhoods, on natural resources, on existing community development plans, on transportation and the transportation systems, you know, in this area, and generally to be concerned about area livability. So the commission develops and adopts long-range plans for 9 areas within its jurisdiction. And then it reviews the implementation of adopted plans, and it assures that the long-range plans guide future development of major state land and facilities, facility holdings, and to assure that those plans are updated to achieve the goals of a comprehensive and coordinated plan of development. Now, finally, just so you know how our statutory authority works, no state project can proceed in the jurisdiction of the Capitol Planning Commission without the commission's approval. Our decisions are quasi-judicial decisions. They are appealable to LUBA. We must make findings that indicate compliance with adopted plans, with state guidelines, with commission-adopted plans, land use plans, and local comprehensive plans and zoning guidelines, pretty much like a planning commission at a local jurisdiction might carry out. But our goal, then, is to make decisions that successfully implement these adopted plans, but also to do so in a way that balances competing policies and interests. So, and perhaps this is maybe more a function of the role of the staff and the commission leadership, but one of the commission's goals is to administer a process that involves all the relevant parties in siting, locating, and modifying state buildings and facilities. And so we act as a kind of a go-between between state government and local interests. So you can see how the role has evolved pretty dramatically from those early days of preserving state land to now functioning as a go-between between state government and local interests. A state project never goes forward to the commission in a way that would override local interests, whether they be city interests, city planning and zoning guidelines, neighborhood interests or interests having to do with historic preservation or natural resources. Land uses, transportation and traffic issues, neighborhood impacts, environmental impacts, project design are all elements of the review that the Capital Planning Commission carries out. And I should point out that there's never in recent history been an appeal, even though I said our decisions are appealable, there's never been an appeal of a commission decision. We operate with a win-win model with a very collaborative approach to assure that all the interests are addressed as projects go forward. So having said all that, let me just now describe it ever so briefly the work program for the next biennium. The commission has always found itself in a situation where it is balancing between the review of specific projects and the development and maintenance of long-range plans. In some years, there's more planning, and other years, there's more review of projects. Of course, a lot of that is a function of the financial resources that are given to agencies to do capital facilities building. And our assessment for the next biennium is that there is a fairly good balance between those two functions. There is, before the legislature requests or numerous requests for capital projects, a natural resources building on the Capitol Mall, a parking structure on the Capitol Mall, relocation of the Capitol Mall houses up at the end of the Capitol Mall to provide a buffer between the development of state facilities and its adjoining neighborhood. There's money in being requested for planning for a justice building on the Capitol Mall. The forestry complex has received money in the last biennium and is requesting additional money in the next biennium to rebuild substantially a number of their old and antiquated buildings on State Street. The State Fair has asked for resources to renovate the State Fair buildings as well. All of those projects will come before the Capital Planning Commission if they are funded. But on the planning side, we are anticipating the completion of a planning document relating to the State Hospital and Penitentiary Plan, and we are also reviewing the disposition of Fairview and Corrections property, and we are also planning to do an update of one additional plan. And that's essentially what I had to say, other than the details of our budget, which, not as you may have noticed, is not very complicated. We have a staff of 2, and there is an allocation of 1.63 FTE, and we're requesting no significant changes to our budget.
Thank you very much. We are short on time today. I apologize for the shortness of time. And so, in the essence of time, what we'll do is we'll go ahead and carry this over till tomorrow. We'll now carry over Senate Bill 5503, Capital Planning Commission, public hearing, and possible work session until tomorrow. We'll go ahead and gavel that. And I understand that. Did we have testimony on 5541, Senate Bill 5541 earlier? I understand that testimony was then given on the Department of Revenue. So what we'll do is we'll just reschedule the Department of Revenue until such time as we can get that language incorporated into a single bill so that we all have the benefit of looking at the bill itself. And we'll reschedule that under the 36-hour schedule. So I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 5541 as well. We'll take up an even hour tomorrow. Thank you very much.
I'm just wondering, this seems, the Capital Planning Commission seems like such a relatively simple budget. Would it be necessary for them to return for us to go through a quick work session and get through it?
They're certainly invited back to the work session if they would like to come. And I'd like an opportunity, of course, to be able to go through the line items with our legislative system when we do that. So thank you very much.